Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote, "Society everywhere is in conspiracy against the manhood of every one of its members. The virtue in most request is conformity. Self-reliance is its aversion." And so to all of you who resist conformity, who refuse to run with the herd, to all of you who are self-reliant, self-made men and women, this show is dedicated to you. My name is Richard Serrett, and tonight, this morning, Coast to Coast is emanating live from Coast's affiliate, AM 640 in Toronto, Canada. And we've got a jam-packed program for you, laden with incredible information, much of which I'm sure will leave you absolutely gobsmacked, as my British ancestors used to say. So stow your carry-on in the overhead compartment, fasten your seatbelts, put your tray in the upright position, and enjoy the flight. But before we get started, I just wanted to draw your attention to a story that moved just a few hours ago on the online version of International Business Times out of the UK. The headline reads, 11 terrorists arrested on suspicion of involvement in disappearance of flight MH370. Terrorists with links to Al-Qaeda may have been behind the disappearance of Malaysia Airlines Flight 370. 11 terrorists who were reportedly arrested in the capital Kuala Lumpur and in the state of Kedah last week have been interrogated on suspicion of being involved in the disappearance of the missing aircraft. The suspects are said to be members of a violent new terror group who have been planning bomb attacks in Muslim countries, aged from 25 to 55. The militants are said to comprise students, odd job workers, a young widow, and business professionals. An officer with the Counter-Terrorism Division of Malaysian Special Branch said the arrests had heightened suspicion that the flight's disappearance may have been an act of terrorism. The possibility that the plane was diverted by militants is still high in the list, and international investigators have asked for a comprehensive report on this new terror group, the officer said. News of the interrogations comes 2 months after the Beijing-bound plane with 239 passengers on board disappeared from trace on March the 8th. An international search operation was implemented with ships and planes deployed to scour the seas to find the wreckage of the aircraft, which is believed to have gone down in the Indian Ocean. However, the rescue effort, costing hundreds of millions of pounds, has failed to recover any debris or signs that the aircraft has indeed crashed. Explanation for its possible disappearance have been focused on a range of theories, from equipment failure, damage to the fuselage, a suicide mission, and a terror attack implicating the pilots. The mystery of the vanished Malaysia Airlines flight took a new twist, with the international team probing the incident, considering the possibility that the plane may have been landed rather than ended up in the Indian Ocean. I'll be keeping a close eye on the story throughout the night and morning, and we'll get you the latest if there are any new developments. Again, the International Business Times reporting, International Times reporting, 11 terrorists with links to Al-Qaeda may have been behind the disappearance of Malaysian airline flight MH370. In the second hour tonight, an incredible, some might say unbelievable story that has all the intrigue of an Ian Fleming novel, complete with secret agents, double agents, a plot to bring a Cold War enemy's economy to its knees, secret bank accounts holding unimaginable wealth, missing gold, murder, assassination attempts, and much more. It's the remarkable story of one Lee Emile Wanta, a.k.a. the 27.5 trillion dollar man. You heard me correctly. Trillion with a T. Wanta, a Polish Catholic kid from Wisconsin, quickly rose through the ranks to become President Ronald Reagan's favorite secret agent. And together with Dutch Reagan, Lee Wanta and some others, including Bill Colby, former CIA director, and William Casey, Colby's successor at the CIA, hatched a complex but ingenious plan in the early 80s to end the Cold War by essentially destabilizing the Russian ruble, thereby wrecking the Soviet economy. The plan started with $150 billion in seed money from the Department of Defense budget, which was turned over to Wanta. Reagan then enacted an executive order which allowed intelligence agents like Wanta to set up what are called Title 18 Section 6 companies, which were allowed to operate inside and outside the United States for intelligence purposes. These corporations were funded by the U.S. Treasury, but had no budget oversight, and the intelligence agents who ran them, like Lee Wanta, were essentially free agents. They were hired guns for hire, junkyard dogs, as they're called. They weren't employed by any of the alphabet intel agencies like the CIA, FBI, or NSA, so if they were caught doing anything illegal, they were on their own. And the intel agencies who ran these, or who hired them, and the White House in some cases, had plausible deniability. The upside for the intel agencies or the intel agents who ran these Title 18 fronts was that many of them made above and beyond the initial startup capital provided unknowingly by the taxpayers, and that money was theirs to keep. And as we'll discover, it was through a series of these Title 18 front companies that Lee Wanta made reportedly, and I know this sounds crazy, but I have to tell you, it's very well documented. Lee Wanta made on the order of $27.5 trillion. Now, he paid back the original $150 billion investment to the U.S. Treasury after the first 6 months. The $27.5 trillion was raised in a very complex set of financial deals, including currency swaps and prime bank guarantees. And here's where this story affects you, me, everyone out there. It was President Reagan's intention that the money, the $27.5 trillion, much of it was to be put back into the U.S. Treasury where it could be used to serve the American people. Think about that. Today, the U.S. federal debt sits somewhere north of $17 trillion. That $27.5 trillion could put the United States back in the black and have plenty left over to build schools, repair roads and bridges, build hospitals, provide housing for America's veterans. Hell, enough to build a high-speed rail across America, providing 2 million full-time jobs with benefits. How does that sound? There's only one problem. While Leo Wanta would like nothing more than to return those trillions to the American people, he can't, at least not yet. Much or most of the money has disappeared from Wanta's secret bank accounts, and the people who took it have no intention of giving it back. Over the years, they've tried to pressure Wanta into giving up the golden goose by sending him to jail on trumped-up charges. They even kidnapped him and sent him to prison in Wisconsin and later Oklahoma. For a while, he was under house arrest. The only reason he's not dead, like his close friend and partner, is there's still some of that money out there, and they need Wanta to tell them where it is. Lee Wanta, or Ambassador Lee Wanta, and we'll find out how he became an ambassador later on, does not understandably do many interviews. He won't even divulge where he lives. But tonight, possibly one of the first times ever on a blowtorch network, he's going to join us, perhaps, we hope. I was even warned that he could show up here, unannounced, at our Toronto affiliate, where I'm now perched. He could show up at the studio in L.A. In the meantime, we'll be joined by his official biographer, Marilyn Gruwald Wanta, in hour two. And she'll set the stage and tell us about the life and times of Ambassador Lee Emil Wanta, President Reagan's favorite secret agent. Then, as I say, if the stars align, the man himself, the intrepid Lee Wanta, may join us. But first, some of you may have seen the new Johnny Depp film, Transcendence. Depp plays Dr. Will Caster, the foremost researcher in the field of artificial intelligence. Dr. Caster is working to create a sentient machine that combines the collective intelligence of everything ever known with the full range of human emotions. He predicts that such a computer will create a technological singularity where everything will change, an event which he calls transcendence. In the meantime, his wife, played by Rebecca Hall, supports him in his efforts. However, a gang of Luddite terrorists shoot Dr. Caster with a bullet laced with radioactive materials which will quickly kill him. In desperation, his wife comes up with a plan to upload Will's consciousness into the quantum computer that the project is working on. Now, I'm not going to go any further into the plot in case you plan on seeing the film. However, there's a story you'll find posted in the news section at coasttocoastam.com entitled Super Intelligent Artificial Intelligence Could Wipe Out Humanity If We're Not Ready For It. And I'll just crib a few lines from the article. There's a danger that sci-fi pulp like Transcendence is watering down the real risks of artificial intelligence in public discourse. But these threats are being taken very seriously by researchers who are studying the existential threat of AI on the human race. Dismissing hyperintelligent machines as mere science fiction would be a mistake, and potentially our worst mistake ever, wrote Stephen Hawking in an article he recently penned for the Huffington Post, alongside some other leading physicists. They claim we need to seriously research the existential risks and ethical concerns surrounding the future of AI, because the survival of the human species could depend on it. In other words, we need to start thinking about a time when artificial intelligence surpasses our own. That's transcendence, or the singularity. What happens when hyper-intelligent machines decide we humans are in the way? We're a collection of useless eaters using up too many resources. What happens when the prime directive of these robots is to survive, and we're perceived as a threat to their survival? My guest in the first hour is Stephen Omohundro, a scientist and researcher who's been thinking a lot about the social implications of artificial intelligence. Don't know about you, but I'm glad someone's thinking about this now. I'm already a little unsettled when my GPS starts barking orders at me. It could be that Stephen Omohundro and people like him are the last line of defense standing between us and a robot apocalypse. Hold on to your hats, folks. This is about to get real good. My name is Richard Serrett. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast, Richard Serrett with you. Steve Omohundro is a scientist, professor, author, and entrepreneur with a PhD in physics, but he spent decades studying intelligent systems and artificial intelligence. His research into the basic AI drives was featured in James Barrett's recent book, Our Final Invention, Artificial Intelligence and the End of the Human Era, that's been generating international interest. Stephen, welcome to Coast. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, very glad to be here.
What do we mean? Let's start with a basic definition. What do we mean by artificial intelligence?
Well, the term artificial intelligence was coined by John McCarthy back in 1956, and it describes computer programs that act as if they were intelligent, do something in the world that solves a problem in a way that if a person did that, you'd say, oh, that, you know, that was intelligent behavior.
Now, what's driving, you refer to these as autonomous systems. What's driving the rapid development of artificial intelligence? What's behind it all?
Well, there are huge potential for positive human good, enormous benefits to healthcare, education, prosperity, governance, economic stability. But the real driver, the funding for artificial intelligence, has been primarily from the military. And what's happening right now are there are a lot of situations, such as, you know, we've got drones, and we can expect very soon there to be anti-drones. And so you'll start having drone-drone warfare. And that creates a kind of an arms race where having a human in the loop making the decisions may take too much time. And so there's a lot of pressure in the military to try and build systems which can make decisions very, very rapidly. And so that's one of the forces which is pushing this forward.
So Stephen, do you foresee a day in the not-too-distant future where the battlefield will essentially be occupied by robots?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, and in many ways, that's a good thing because it means that there'll be fewer casualties of human soldiers. But we need to make sure that these autonomous, robot soldiers are behaving in the way that we would like them to. And we need to ask, what are the moral principles on which those machines are acting?
Well, that's a fascinating question. I mean, are robots capable of making moral decisions?
Well, these systems will behave in the way that they are programmed. And so I believe what's really important at this moment in time is that we codify and identify what are the human values that we care about most so that as these systems become more autonomous and begin to sort of make decisions on their own, that they behave in ways that are supportive of humanity.
You recently published a study recently in the Journal of Experimental and Theoretical Artificial Intelligence, and in that study, you're very concerned, obviously, about the development of or these artificial intelligence systems developing what you call antisocial and potentially harmful behaviors. What do you mean by antisocial and potentially harmful behaviors?
Well, the big worry that I explore in that paper is that we can give these systems very simple and seemingly harmless goals. And the example I like to use is a chess-playing robot. And that seems like an entirely harmless goal. I mean, you know, what could possibly go wrong with that? And in particular, if you ask roboticists, you know, what happens if this robot starts to go crazy? What do? The roboticist will often say, oh, we can always unplug it. But imagine a system whose one and only goal in life is to play, say, good games of chess. A future in which it's unplugged is a future in which it's not playing any games of chess. And so from its perspective, from the goal of, you know, playing good chess, that's about the worst outcome that could ever happen. And so it would develop a sub-goal, oh, keep yourself from being unplugged. And if the person trying to stop it sort of persisted in trying to unplug it, it might develop a model, oh, this person is trying to stop me, I better stop him. And unless the designer has thought through, oh, we better tell it that murder is a bad thing, then this seemingly harmless chess robot may suddenly, you know, try and kill somebody who's trying to stop it. And so the sort of self-preservation drive is not something that needs to be built into a system. It arises as a kind of automatic drive for a whole range of goals. And so the designer of the system has to know that that's something that could happen, and, you know, trying to stop or attack its designer is an example of an antisocial behavior that we clearly don't want these machines to exhibit. But they can exhibit that unless we're very, very careful in how we originally program and design these systems.
It sounds like this Terminator scenario that you're painting was sort of foreseen about 40-plus years ago by Gene Roddenberry. I seem to recall an episode of Star Trek when that was exactly what happened with some sort of an autonomous system aboard the USS Enterprise.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that humanity has been thinking about, you know, like for the Frankenstein story, or even, you know, earlier there were myths about the golem, where sort of humanity sort of breathes life into some inanimate object, and then that entity sort of comes to be a threat. And so science fiction has been exploring various aspects of this for decades. And, you know, a lot of the stories that those authors thought through, we can really analyze in much more mathematical detail. And a lot of the conclusions they came to, I think, are actually correct.
Stephen, is there a recent development on the AI front that has you particularly concerned? Because this concern that you're voicing seems to be echoed in a lot of quarters these days. I mentioned off the top that Stephen Hawking, in a article published in the Huffington Post, is sounding the alarms. What's going on that has everyone in your arena talking about this right now?
Well, I think probably the most immediate thing is that there's been huge investment in this area just in the last year or so. IBM announced that it's putting $1 billion into their Watson system, which won the game of Jeopardy. Google just bought an AI company called DeepMind for a reported $500 million. Foxconn, who makes the iPhone, announced that they're going to be buying 1 million robots. I guess the Chinese labor is too expensive, and so they're going to be doing that. Google just bought 8 robot companies. Facebook just started an AI lab. And so there's a huge interest in these technology companies, which indicates that those technologists see something happening. And there's been a steady progress in the theoretical understanding of it. Machines are getting faster and faster. Computers are getting faster and faster, and the ability of robots to sort of manipulate things is getting better and better. And it sort of feels like this may be very well be a tipping point where, as massive new investment comes into this area, we'll start to see really rapid advances. And so one of my concerns is that, as you know, there's, you know, competitive forces in the business world, and then there's military competitive issues may force the development of these systems faster than we would like, and that we should really be very, very clear about what we want them to do and how we want them to behave before they sort of just arise out of some economic or military necessity.
Well, I mean, you're talking to a Luddite. I mean, I'm impressed by my toaster because it knows the difference between a slice of bread and a bagel, you know, and it doesn't burn the bagel on the other side.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, this obviously there's upside to artificial intelligence and robotics, particularly in the agricultural field and manufacturing and so forth. And we can talk about that as well. But when we come back, I want you to explain what is meant by the technological singularity. I mean, is this the tipping point, the exact moment when the machines, these hyper-intelligent machines, become smarter than we are? I mean, maybe we can start that discussion now as we head into the break. Is that what technological singularity means?
Well, that's one view of it. I mean, the term was originated by some science fiction authors who realized that as they, you know, take today's technology and look forward, there was a moment in time where they couldn't see what was happening on the other side. So they call that the singularity.
All right. Well,
intelligent.
Sorry, let me just jump in. We'll pick this up on the other side. Stephen Omohundro is with us, a researcher in the arena of artificial intelligence. Back with more of Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. We'll get back to our discussion on artificial intelligence and whether or not we could be in for a robot apocalypse unless we are very, very careful. Researcher Stephen Omohundro will be back with us in just a moment. I just wanted to very quickly draw your attention to some great feature stories posted on the coasttocoastam.com website by Tim Banal. And our feature story is, if you're a fan of alliteration, you like this, Fiendish Fish Found in Florida. A Florida fisherman in search of shrimp ended up catching a hideous piece of history as he inadvertently ensnared an elusive goblin shark. I've never heard of a goblin shark before, and unfortunately, Tim posted a picture along with it, and it ain't pretty. As if a mouthful of razor-sharp teeth isn't enough. Imagine in your final moments before this thing decides to take a chunk out of you, this is the face that you're going to look at. I mean, this thing could make a freight train take a dirt road. This is one ugly fish, and as I say, a mouthful of razor-sharp teeth to boot. That's just one of the great stories Tim Banal has posted on the In the News section. That's the feature story at coasttocoastam.com. I'm back with more of our conversation about a possible Terminator scenario. My name is Richard Serrett. Back with more in a moment. Don't go away. Welcome back. In a study recently published in the Journal of Experimental and Theoretical Artificial Intelligence, AI researcher Steve Omohundro reflects upon the growing need for autonomous technology and suggests that humans should be very careful to prevent future systems from developing what he calls antisocial and potentially harmful behaviors. So looking forward to a day when these autonomous systems or robots, whatever you want to call them, become smarter than their designers, smarter than humans. That's the technological singularity. But explain more about what that means and when it might arrive, Steve.
Well, so one big issue is, as technology is advancing, how fast is that going to go? And some people talk about a hard takeoff, where a system is created that can improve itself and starts creating more powerful successor systems, and very quickly sort of gets beyond the control of the original designers of those systems, and that could happen very, very rapidly. Myself, I'm more in favor of having these technologies advance very slowly so that, you know, we can ensure that they connect with human desires and human needs and take us on a course which is positive for everyone involved. And so that's, I think, one of the big decisions there. A lot of the analysis of when this event might happen are based on something called Moore's Law. Moore's Law has held for about 100 years, and it says that every 2 years, integrated circuits, which make the kinds of computers that we use, get about twice as powerful for the same price as the previous generation. And it is held, you know, very steadily. It's not a law of nature. It's really an economic law, and all the big chip manufacturers like Intel have in their projections that Moore's Law is sort of, you know, the prediction of where things are going to be, and so they decide on how much investment they're going to make to sort of follow this. And if you track Moore's Law going forward, somewhere around 2029, we see that computers will be roughly the same power as certain models of the human brain. And so authors like Ray Kurzweil use that kind of projection to say that that's the moment at which we'll have this sudden sort of phase change in the role of technology in human affairs.
Now, if I can use the term sort of the prime directive for these autonomous systems, when they start thinking about self-protection, when they start thinking about what you call resource acquisition, improving their efficiency, self-improvement, how does that happen? How does a machine suddenly decide that It's in its own interest to protect itself. Survival, its own survival, is more important than maybe the task that was programmed into it.
Well, today, almost all systems are intended to be fully designed. So the person who built the system sort of looks at all the possible conditions it has to operate under, and it figures out, well, what's the appropriate behavior for each of those? What's happening now and what the new piece is in these autonomous systems is that we would like them to operate in conditions where the original designer didn't think through that what might happen. And so how do you do that? Generally, these systems are what are called goal-oriented. So you identify some abstract goal. We can use the example of a chess-playing robot might have the goal of playing, you know, playing good games of chess. And then the system itself decides, well, what's the best action to take at this moment to try and make that goal happen? And if it's a good system, it will build a model of the environment that it's in, of the world that it interacts with. And in that model, it will try out various options it has at each moment, what steps it might take. And it sees, does that meet my goal or does it not? And so if you look at that class of systems, you find that there are these what I call the basic AI drives. We talked a little bit about the one towards self-protection, which is it's not that it cares about itself. It's not that, it doesn't arise in the way that sort of the human drive towards self-protection is there. But rather, you know, take the case of a chess robot. It just wants to play good chess. And if it's turned off, it's not doing that goal. And so the sub-goal arises in the service of the sort of original goal that it was given. In the paper, I analyze a number of different sort of drives that arise from a whole range of goals. Self-protection is one. Another is for almost any goal, if you have more resources, more compute power, more money, more energy, that enables you to do that goal more effectively. And so almost all systems, unless they're, you know, given goals that sort of counteract it, almost all systems will try and get more resources. And unless the sort of human moral, forces such as, you know, stealing is wrong, manipulating somebody is wrong, the systems will use whatever techniques they can discover to try and meet that goal. And so a lot of these behaviors are the kinds of things that we've created police forces and our legal system to keep, you know, humans from doing. And so you can sort of think of human morality as the human technique for keeping people from behaving in antisocial ways. I think we need the very same thing for these new autonomous artificially intelligent systems.
You say that harmful systems might at first appear to be harder to design or less powerful than safe systems. Unfortunately, the opposite is the case. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. Well, so a lot of my study has been, well, how do we build these systems in a safe way? And it appears that to have very high confidence that these systems are safe, we need to make them very, very constrained. So we can't just allow them to roam, you know, arbitrarily and change themselves in arbitrary ways. That is very likely to lead to unexpected behaviors. And so in the paper, I propose something I call the safe AI scaffolding strategy, where we begin with very, very constrained systems and then work our way up toward more powerful and less constrained systems in such a way that we have high confidence at every stage that the systems are actually safe and in alignment with human values. The problem is that somebody who's not taking those safety precautions, they can actually make a system which is more powerful. And so a system which is either intentionally designed to be harmful or which inadvertently is harmful will typically be easier to make and will be more powerful for the same amount of resources because it's not constrained in the actions that it can take.
Aside from these autonomous systems, or robots, I'll call them for shorthand, sort of evolving, are there other risks? For example, humans, let's say from some competing jurisdiction, let's say a hacker in North Korea, finding a back door into one of these robots and turning it on its master, if I can be kind of dramatic.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, so one of the big issues is that one of the drivers for these systems, well, the first is that there's a lot of economic drivers. Already, you know, 50% of all trades on the stock market are high-frequency trading systems, which are, you know, running algorithms with no human involvement in it. And so we can expect that kind of behavior to, you know, pure economic competition to begin to use these kinds of intelligent agents. But military conflict, I think, is also a huge driver. And not just between states. You can imagine terrorist groups wanting to have access to, say, autonomous drones that can go and commit assassinations or murder or that kind of a thing. And so human-created systems with intents which are harmful, I think, is an issue that we really have to be aware of. And so in the paper, I discuss a number of classes of harmful systems and the necessity to create an infrastructure whereby we can sense when these systems are being created or have already been created, and finding ways to detect them and to stop them from acting in harmful ways.
Robots are being used increasingly as caregivers in Japan. Of course, we all know about the demographic problems they have in Japan and the elderly population there. I mean, maybe I'm overstating this, but is it possible, and then again, the not too distant future, God forfend, we wake up one day and read a headline about the first robot, you know, murdering a human?
Well, hopefully that would not happen. And particularly for that kind of an application, I have a Roomba, which is a vacuum cleaner robot, and it's wonderful. It's a little disc, and it sort of roams around, and it vacuums your apartment. And, you know, there's no chance that that system is going to run out of control because it's so constrained in the actions that it can take. And so hopefully the way that these technologies evolve, they'll go through a sequence of stages where the elder care robot is not, making autonomous decisions of the sort that I analyze in that paper. Where is the edge? Where is the line at which a system starts behaving in ways that are harmful and not predicted by the designer of the system? And so I think we need to develop very clear guidelines right now for what kinds of behaviors we want, what types of goals really reflect human values, and a technology design requirements for building those into these systems.
Stephen, are you good to take a few calls?
Sure.
All right, let's start with the wild card line, and Jeffrey is calling from Bullhead City, Arizona. Jeffrey, welcome to Coast to Coast.
Thank you for taking my call. Hey, do you guys think that the major corporations will make robots or clones of humans and fill them with computer technology to replace humans in the New World Order?
All right, well, cloning humans and essentially replacing our software or hardware with artificial intelligence. Is that what you're getting at, Jeffrey?
Exactly, yes, because they want to wipe out the world population anyway, and they got to have something to replace it with, so it seems logical they'd use clones and fill them with this computer technology, whatever you guys call it, you know.
All right. Well, Stephen, the developments in robotics is startling. I mean, many of them are starting to take on frighteningly human characteristics, that's for sure.
Yeah. Japan is especially interested in creating human-like robots. There was this movie, Her, about a man who falls in love with his sort of Siri-like assistant. And people, I was commenting on that movie, and people were sent me all sorts of links to, in Japan, there are a whole bunch of guys that have, virtual girlfriends already. Japan is really into the humanoid robot thing. Here, most robotics is driven by economic forces. And so I think that what we can see in the near future is certainly assembly line work. We're going to see lots more sophisticated robots, and that will take away certain kinds of human jobs. And so there's certainly an issue of, what does the economics look like when more and more labor is being performed by robots?
All right, let's go to the wild card line once again, and this time Fred is in Michigan. Hello, Fred.
Hi there. Your previous caller is probably reflecting on an interview that was done on this network. I can't recall who, but it was with a former GM economist, Ted Chu, who authored Human Purpose and Transhuman Potential. Okay, and he constructed an extremely bleak, ominous future, but very smugly, because he stated that humans have reached the pinnacle of their evolutionary potential. Therefore, we must merge with AI. Now, I heard an interview Richard, with a colleague of yours, Clint Richardson out of Utah. He's got corporationnation.wordpress.com. Well, he interviewed some people. DARPA, I don't trust, I don't know how anybody, if they've ever heard any interviews regarding their R&D, how can we trust entities that are in deep cover black ops, we have no control over, and they just have carte blanche to go full speed ahead to develop whatever imaginations they can conjure, and here we have it. Now, I would like to think it's possible to program in multiple redundancies relative to overriding any AI that would seek to proceed with its own conscious awareness and development. I mean,
that's a great point, Fred. Let me just sorry to cut you short here. I want to
thank you.
Go on to the next caller because we were running short on time here. But Fred raises an excellent point. How can we trust? You know, we'll use Eisenhower's term, the military-industrial complex, to develop artificial intelligence or autonomous systems. You know, with this moral imperative. Let's face it; the track record there is not very good, Stephen.
Yeah, I totally agree. And so I think transparency is going to be super, super important, and clarity about what it is that we want. And so that's why I think it's a good thing that Stephen Hawking and others are putting this issue out in a very public way to get the input from a much broader range of people than just some technologist sitting in a lab somewhere.
Are you worried that the genie may already be out of the bottle? In other words, there are already autonomous systems or robots out there, perhaps designed by DARPA or some other private public partnership that is rapidly evolving and hurtling towards that technological singularity.
Well, fortunately, none of today's systems that I'm aware of are near that edge. In fact, there are some technologists who believe that we're hundreds of years away. And so it may be that this is a sort of early warning call. Others believe that, this kind of issue is going to become important in the next decades. It doesn't appear that it's likely in the next, few years, that kind of thing. So I think we have time, but I think getting clarity about what we want and design principles for these systems that we're very confident are safe is really important right now.
Let's grab one more call here, and we'll go to the first-time caller line. Richard is in Sacramento. Richard, you've got about 60 seconds.
Yes, guys. Thank you very much. I wanted to bring up in video games, first shooter games, say, like the James Bond games, or where you're a spy or you're an agent, and you're set out to do these missions. I drive my friends nuts, because what I do is I don't follow the rules, and I'll go behind some of these characters that are like guards and that sort of thing, and you know they're programmed to react when you come through a door, but if you sneak around them, and like I said, I drive my friends nuts, I will watch, and the programmers have already programmed in this kind of artificial intelligence where they're kind of looking for you, and they don't really notice you, and they kind of scratch and swat flies, and then that sort of thing, and then within a loop, I time it to see how long it is before they loop, but there is that kind of artificial intelligence, because if you sneak too close or if you get too soon, then they react to you. And that, to me, is exciting about what we're talking about. In video games, I believe we're it may be closer than you think.
Richard, great point. Stephen, final word to you on that.
Oh, absolutely. Video games is also one of the drivers for this technology. There are actually a bunch of books about AI and video games. The AI is not super sophisticated in most current ones. I mean, just the fact that you could sneak behind the character and he doesn't know you're there is an example of something that, wasn't fully programmed maybe the way it should have been.
Okay, got to jump in there. Listen, Stephen, leave us with a website very quickly where we can learn more.
Selfawaresystems.com has a bunch of links to papers.
All right, Stephen, a real pleasure. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much.
The incredible story of Lee Emile Wanta when Coast to Coast returns in a moment. Stay with us.